You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. Welcome to I'm Ready for My Close-Up. I'm Virginie Selavi, editor of Electric Sheep, the magazine for transgressive cinema, which can be found at www.electricsheepmagazine.com. Today, I'm talking to Israeli artist, writer and filmmaker Roy Rosen, who is presenting his first UK solo exhibition, Vile Evil Veil, at INEVA, the Institute of International Visual Arts at Rivington Place. There are two works in the exhibition. First, an installation entitled Live and Die as Eva Braun, which explores the life of Hitler's lover in the bunker at the end of the Second World War through a series of 10 panels with text and images. The other work is the film Out, which stages a sadomasochist exorcism between a queer left-wing activist as the dominatrix and a right-wing woman possessed by the spirit of ultra-nationalist Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. So let's talk about Out first. Can you explain a bit more about the political context?
Well, the political context in Israel, as I see it, is basically a simulation of diversity. There are three parties that supposedly are different: Labour, Kadima, which is the centre party, and Likud, which is supposedly moderate right. But I think I perceive them all as basically being the same, which is right-wing parties. Avigdor Lieberman is the outspoken ultra-fascist minister who is in fact a potential collaborator with each and every one of those parties. So in fact it's a very frustrating situation by which there is quite a vast contingency of Israelis who may be left-wing leaning, but they do not really have a viable representation in the parliament right now. And in a way, marking Lieberman, because he is outspoken as the extreme right wing, helps in preserving this simulation of diversity.
Okay, and so you you represent those ideas, those political ideas, through a sadomasochist relationship mm-hmm. between two women.
Yeah.
How did you choose those two women? How did you find them?
Well, I must say that for me the film began not with Lieberman proper, but rather with the thought of a machine, a speech machine. The notion that a sadomasochistic session of giving and receiving pain may be turned into a machine of emitting sentences, and that by having those sentences be the sentences of someone else rather than the one who's being beaten, a ritual of pain and pleasure can also become an exorcism, which is already pertinently political in many ways. But it is important to understand that the structural thought preceded the political critique, so to speak, the concrete political critique. But once I realized that I do want to tackle the figure of Lieberman, I had very short time. I was invited by one of the programmers at the Venice Film Festival to submit a new piece, and I had no budget and practically no time. I had to find to do all the research and to find the performers within several weeks. Fortunately enough, Yoana Gonen, who is the dominant, who's a radical queer left-wing activist, knew my work very well. We hang in similar circles. She knew a former project that I did, which also had many connections to sadomasochism. And she also realized immediately what my political vantage point was. So she was immediately in it. Finding the submissive was much more laborious, and in fact, I only found her 72 hours before we had to shoot the film.
Oh, wow.
So it was in many ways like a strange kind of miracle, because not only is she unbelievably smart, she's not an intellectual at all, she has a completely different perspective than someone like Yoana does, but she is very, very smart in a very genuine way. But also the fact that she comes from, you know, geographically from a place very close to where Lieberman came from, you know, from the ex-Soviet Union, and the fact that she comes from a family of Lieberman voters had made the whole theme of possession literally belong to her, you know, as if it was written for her. So it was an incredibly lucky process. Also because Joanna, as anyone who would see the film would realize, she's a very, the one who's beating is actually very, very sensitive, shy, nervous. And she would not work with just anyone. We were, because of that, we were also looking for an alternative dominant, you know, just in case that she would not have a good dialogue with Ella. But Ella came into the project so passionately that pretty soon they had chemistry and it worked out.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the film, that it really challenges easy assumptions that you have the shy, sensitive, left-wing activist who's the dominatrix, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you have the right-wing, forceful, very assertive woman as the submissive one.
Oh, right.
And you seem very interested in that, in the role reversal, in the torturer and the victim, the master and the slave.
Yes, and I think, in fact, it's a part and parcel of certainly the masochist fantasy from the very beginning, because masochism, as you know, was a term coined by Richard von Krafft-Ebing, this psychiatrist in the 19th century, after Leopold von Sacher Masoch, the great writer who was a masochist, who also believed in the, or hoped for the return of matriarchal society. But of course the paradox of the masochist fantasy is that it is dictated by the victim. So it is the victim who is in fact in charge, he's the one who asserts his will, he's the one who, for all intents and purposes, writes the contract by which he will be then abused. So I think that masochism in particular, and sadomasochism as a practice in general, has this ability to reverse, you know, our preconceived notions of how power is being distributed.
Yeah, and so Joanna talks about it quite explicitly in the film. She says every relationship is about power games, and sadomasochism just makes it brings it out.
Exactly.
So through that very specific sexual and maybe emotional practice, you you're talking also about politics,
right,
about when you think about the top and the bottom,
mm-hmm.
Well, actually, who dominates?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting, because it seemed to me that, I mean, there's always this talk about the personal and the political, but I thought what you did was really interesting, because it seemed to put the political relationships, to inscribe it into a reflection on human nature, a much, much wider universal reflection on human nature. Is that the sort of thing that you're interested in?
Yeah, I don't really care for classifications and exclusions. I mean, I think that we experience life as something that is simultaneously fragmentary and interconnected, you know. And whenever we classify or divide between the political and the private, there is something for me highly artificial about it. There is always political implications to our desires, our pleasures, our sense of humor, our fears. And that is something that, you know, it's not like a manifested agenda. I don't set out to do works thinking that I should preach for this kind of hybridity. I just strongly feel that that's the way things are for me, and that, you know, that's why it's reflected in the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was Ella also into sadomasochism for real, or is that?
Yes, yes. In fact, the film, it's only the central scene of the film, which is the beating scene, the ritual of exorcism, which in which Joanna thrashes quite severely, in fact, the buttocks of Ella. The two other scenes, the first one is an interview, supposedly, seemingly a conventional Talking Heads documentary, in which they speak about their lives, their experiences, Israeli politics, and it slightly glides and shifts into an exposition of a fiction by which one is an exorcist and the other is possessed. But whatever import they brought pertaining to their own lives was theirs. It was not dictated by me. So she, in fact, describes in the film how she began being interested in, fantasies and sexual practices other than what she calls vanilla sex. And she... In fact, the way that I found her, she was working for a living, running a sort of a BDSM club beating, you know, basically old horny men. One of her employees was a student of mine, an art student, you know, making extra living, beating, you know, helping her in this job. Yeah.
And you're very interested in this, the fluctuating boundary between documentary and fiction, because you have this documentary aspect in, right, in the interviews, then the staged sadomasochist session. But at the same time, the sadomasochism is actually real, because, like you say, she does get a very sore bottom.
Yes, when I said before that I don't like classifications, I think one of the most dubious classifications is the one between, you know, fact and fiction, documentary and fiction. I think that documentary invariably is manipulative and has an element of fiction in it. It is always a narrative, there is always a vantage point. And the most, let's say, I would use a harsh term, corrupt, the most corrupt documentaries are those who pretend to be disinterested, you know, or objective. Coming to narrative from a more, let's say, intense interest in fiction, I never perceived fiction or fantasy to be disconnected from reality. You know, they're always premised and hinged in our reality, just in the way that, you know, national identity is something that is imagined. You know, what is a Jew or what is an Englishman? You know, these are all what Kaya Silverman would have called, you know, dominant fictions. Exposing those tensions again is something that comes by this point almost intuitively. It's almost the entry point into a project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the film, you also feature some paintings which look medieval in style of scenes of exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
Where did those paintings come from?
Yeah, I did them, and in fact, I didn't think that I would do them. I am primarily a painter initially. I mean, that was my main practice for many years, although I was always working on interdisciplinary projects. But I think in Israel, people identified me first and foremost as a painter. But I'm the kind of painter who would want to justify in each and every painting. I always suspect my medium, you know, I don't want to take it for granted. And for that project, I didn't see any reason to make paintings. I thought I would use pre-existing images of exorcism. But after doing some research, I found out that the history of the iconography of exorcism is rather poor, unlike other topics that I dealt with in the past, like martyrdom, for instance, which is really terrifically rich. So I had something like 48 hours before the shoot, and I set out to do those four miniatures. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Interesting. It's very. Did you copy anything in particular? Were you influenced by anything in particular?
No, I mean, I always do the imagery manually. I'm not using any copying techniques, but there are always sources. You know, they may be direct or indirect. For instance, in one of the in those four miniatures, you see four scenes of exorcism. In which demons come out of different orifices, the vagina, the buttocks, the mouth, and the belly. And in one of them, for instance, there is the what is known as the clown stage in the hysteric seizure. So that's a source from 19th century psychiatry as well, the Salpêtrière, where Charcot had artist and photographer document, you know, the different stages of the hysterical women's palpitations and convulsions. So that is one source. You get to see some patterns with hidden swastikas. I'm always influenced by Japanese erotic prints from the 18th century, so some of that creeps in. So it looks medieval in feel, but it's really a sort of a hybrid, a hodgepodge of different sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and then you have a final sequence in the film,
mm-hmm,
with two men singing,
right,
a song, and it's very staged as well. It's very carefully composed.
Yeah.
And you have Ella lying on the bed, yeah, unconscious or
it's
asleep,
true,
and Joanna sitting at a desk with some kind of container that is,
right,
on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to explain that sequence?
Sure. I mean, there is a scene in a film that I really love, which is W.R. The Mystery of the Organism by Dushan Makaveev. For me, one of the greatest films to deal both with questioning documentary practices, but also with radical sexuality and politics. It's a film in which he tells the story of Wilhelm Reich, this student of Freud who developed his theory of the orgone, this sexual energy, and was persecuted severely by the United States during the late 50s, and died in prison, in fact. The second part of the movie, Makaveyev sets out to tell a story of a Reichian activist who is assassinated by a very handsome Russian blonde ice skater, who then, and here I get to the point, he sings a song of remorse, a very pathetic song, and it's a spectacular outdoor scene. It's in a port. He goes by a white horse, he goes by a little fire where homeless people are warming by, and his hands are bloody, the camera always follows him. And when I was doing the screen test for different musicians and I saw Igor, the guy who plays in the film, I realized that that's my chance to realize the fantasy, to pay twisted homage to Makaveyev. So what we do is really simulate this scene, but indoors, in the very room where all the action of the film took place. Instead of a homeless people around the fire, we have this little fire on the table. Instead of a white horse, we have a cute white dog. And the song, of course, is a completely different song. I mean, it's a song by Sergei Yesenin, a great Russian modernist, was married to Isidora Duncan, died very young. But interestingly enough, he was also a very crucial figure for early Zionist poets. The first wave of Russians who immigrated, you know, socialists who immigrated to Palestine, some of them forged themselves after the image, this romantic image of Yesenin. So for Israeli ears and also for Russian ears, it would ring very familiar in many, many different ways. And in a way, this scene serves because of that as a sort of the highlight of an emotional crescendo, so to speak, because if the film begins being quite alienated from Lieberman, sort of laying out his political opinions, which are really quite horrid, he tries or strives to create a potential of identification by having quotes that have more to do with his private memories and by becoming really more emotional and intimate. And hopefully the song helps to do some of that.
Yeah, because Ioana says at one point that you have to have empathy with the demon,
right,
that in order to exercise it, you have to identify with the demon, which I thought was a really interesting idea. Mm-hmm. And do you feel that this idea of being able to reverse the roles of victim and torturer, or identifying with both, is something that is important to the reflection on Israeli identity?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that this is something that ties the two projects that are shown at Ineva. I mean, they're both dealing with things that are defined as demons, you know, the haunting figure of Adolf Hitler, perhaps the ultimate figure of evil, and that of Avigdor Lieberman, whom certainly for people who would be the potential viewers or readers or people who spectators of Tse, also is perceived as a taboo character. And my challenge really is not to reaffirm this division between a sanctimonious, righteous self who is in the right and the demon who's the victimizer, but rather to try and be self-implicating, self-incriminating, and to turn this process of sleeping with the enemy, so to speak, into a process of self-examination, self-reflection. That is really the great challenge, and which I see projected also onto the viewer. I mean, I hope that if I'm successful, if this luring machine, this seduction machine works, the viewer should find him or herself in a very uncomfortable spot, you know, where what is being questioned is really internal as much as it is external.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Israel history, of course, playing the victim had a major, major role. I mean, Israel always instrumentalized the Holocaust and its own role as representing victimhood for gains. You know, it can be political gains, it can be monetary gains, compensation money from Germany, it can be moral gains, you know, the right to exert aggression towards someone else, because we are in fact the victims. So I think that playing the victim is a very dubious situation, you know, that, yeah.
So was Live and Die as Eva Braun a way of identifying with the demon Eva Braun and exercising it?
Well, I don't. So as I said, I don't really believe in demons. I think that Adolf Hitler and certainly Eva Braun and also Lieberman are all human beings. Human beings have some demonic aspects to them. But I think that the thing that is really important to remember is that there are no demons. You know, the demons are us. I must say that, I'm usually quite slow at work and the projects are quite complex, or if you're critical, they're quite convoluted, entangled. And Eva Braun took about 3 years to make. So there are many different layers to it. But that was certainly a strong part of it. I mean, to look at, because if there is a moral question to be asked, if ethics and aesthetics are related, then we have to ask ourselves, do we only want to give a lecture about an answer that we already know in advance, or are we really asking a question? In order to ask a moral question, you have to be performative. You have to put yourself in a situation where something is open-ended, something is not clear. You might fail. You might find yourself in an embarrassing spot or uncomfortable spot. And I thought that the way to do that was really to test my own limits in terms of this game of identification, which, of course, I mean, you know, Western civilization is premised on it for better and worse. You know, enlightenment is based on identification with the other, as is imperialism and colonialism. You know, the other is like me. So it was the challenge was not to disavow it, not to say you cannot identify, but not to let it appear as if it's a machine that works. You know, to let it operate in a very uncomfortable way, possible and impossible. So when you become Eva Braun and you wait for your lover in the bunker, and you spend the time reading a magazine in your native tongue, which happens to be German, you already find yourself in this incommensurate situation. You know, you may not be understanding your native tongue.
And why Eva Braun and not Hitler?
Well, exactly because, I mean, I think maybe time have changed. Maybe nowadays it would have been easier to deal with Hitler himself. But at the time, I must say that I came to Eva Braun after years in which I felt that the issue of Holocaust representation and this trauma was at the crux of my identity and of what I do, but it was impossible to tackle properly in art. And then I thought, you know, I just felt that it is impossible, but it's even more impossible to keep silent. You know, it would be a real failure. And when I realized that I had this insight that I should try somehow to find a machination, you know, some machine of identification to the intimacy, to the body of the Führer, Hitler seemed impossible to really do it. While Eva Braun, I mean, she was not even a Nazi, you know, she was not an explicitly ideological or political person. Her only real crime, as far as we're concerned, is that she was in love with someone who practically all of Germany was in love with. And she's a sort of a vacuous figure as well. I mean, she can serve as a sort of a vehicle, a conduit, onto which one can project things, you know, that may not really belong to her. And that, in fact, is what happens in the project, because it is about contemporary consciousness rather than about, you know, the authentic historical moment at the bunker, you know. It's more about present society, present rhetorics, my own private memories or reflections.
And what's interesting is that you use both very childish imagery and very sexualized imagery. Why did you choose that approach?
Well, maybe I'm just, you know, a traditional Freudian. I mean, both placing great importance on, you know, a childhood primal scenes, and of course libidinal energy. But I also thought about it as a sort of a trap of seduction, you know, luring the viewer into something that is very promising, you know, a very short, succinct narrative, using all the powers of seduction that I may have, beauty, sexuality, sweetness, you know, childhood imagery, labor-intensive, artwork, and so on and so forth. so that you're lured in, and then you find yourself in a very uncomfortable spot dealing with rather difficult subject matter. But it is also because it reflects, again, self-incommensurate complex that each and every one of us experiences. I mean, we're all children, we all have sexuality, we all are marred by politics. So it seems pretty natural, you know, to have this tainted, unclean concoction. And of course, you know, it's also polemic, because I think that the way that Holocaust representation was treated in the past was usually by one of two ways, if to be very crude about it. One was the proper way was abstraction, you know. So if you have a void, you have an empty space, you can project the impossibility to represent, you know, what is beyond representation, Auschwitz, right? And the other was by way of what in literature they call prosopopeia, speaking for the dead. That is, in a spectacular way, often reenacting, let's say, a ghetto or a concentration camp, but from the vantage point of an identification and speaking for the victim. The most obscene example of which was probably, you know, Steven Spielberg's acceptance speech when he received the Oscar for Schindler's List, thanking the Academy because he spoke for, you know, 6 million dead Jews. So my attempt was really to avoid those two options, not to speak for the victims, not to speak for the dead on the one hand, and not to be properly abstract on the other. So the economy is an economy of an excess of imagery, excess of figuration, introduction of humor, introduction of sexuality into that experience.
And in fact, that approach caused controversy. There was a debate in Parliament, I believe, was it the Ministry of Education?
Many of them. I mean, it started, the show was first exhibited at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem in 1997. I was just returning, lived in New York for 12 years, just returning to Israel. And even before the show opened, the text appeared in a publication in Jerusalem. And the title, I think, by itself, Live and Die Zevavon, sufficed for the initially the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, who was a religious politician, to attack the show, call me a Holocaust denier, threaten to cut the museum budget, and so on and so forth. And he was quickly joined by many, many other politicians from the extreme and also the moderate right. But then once the show opened, the museum in that case was really standing behind me. The show ran its course. I mean, they added some, you know, warning signs in the entry to the gallery space. But other than that, I think it was a lot of pressure for me. I mean, I knew that there may be a scandal, but visual artists usually, you know, live in a more or less protected atmosphere. It's not very often that you encounter something like that. So experiencing it was quite stressful. It was, you know, life, death threats and things like that. But it was okay in the end.
Were you surprised, maybe because you had just come back from New York? Was it a very different kind
of context? No, I was not surprised. I mean, I was unprepared for the intensity, but I knew that I was doing something that was completely unheard of within Israeli artistic and literary discourse at that point. I simply knew it. I know Israeli art and culture fairly well. I was, as I said, I was working on the project for 3 years, so I was looking for precursors, you know, for things that can support me, for people I can feel identified with. And I found a few, you know, mostly amongst, critical historians,
Okay, thank you very much. That's all we have time for. Hoe Rosen, Vile Evil Veil, is at Eniva at Rivington Place from the 21st of March to the 5th of May. For more information, please go to www.eniva.org. That's INIVA.org.